Jay and Bridge has always had a special spot in the world of enterprise Java. If you're not familiar with them, they're the company that bridges the gap between Microsoft's .NET world and enterprise Java computing. But this year, CTO Wayne Citrin isn't going to be talking about .NET and Microsoft. He's actually going to be talking about Java 9 development. Or more specifically, he's hosting a Birds of a Feather session on Monday night about what legacy developers can do to use some of the features of Java 9 and take advantage of the latest release. So we got a hold of Wayne Citrin and we asked him, you know, when you start talking about Java 9 and legacy development, what's the big message you want to push out to enterprise software developers?
Well, but the big message is that a lot of the times when a major new release of Java comes out, there's really no room for legacy developers to actually take advantage of this stuff because, you know, you start programming against new APIs, against new language constructs, and it breaks support for the old stuff. And, you know, you can't really... I mean, with the new APIs, you can do all sorts of things like, you know, late binding and reflection and stuff like that. But, you know, new language constructs, you really can't do that. But what I'm talking about this time is that, you know, we're legacy Java developers too. You know, we have products that we need to support going back to Java 5 right now. But the point I wanted to make is that Java 9, they seem to have thought about this problem. And I just wanted to tell legacy developers, you know, you don't have to tune it out. You don't have to tune out the new stuff. You know, they've done things like, you know, multi-release jar files, which I think is a great innovation for in Java 9, and we're looking forward to using it. You know, the whole module system, I think, was really designed to accommodate people who don't have modularized code and just want to stick their toes in and, you know, even if they haven't modularized their jar files, they can participate in the module system. So, you know, you can start by putting them all in the class path and then start migrating them toward the module path even before you've added, you know, module info.class. You can even use multi-release jar files to stick the module info stuff in one of the versioning sections and leave it out of the, you know, the main section of the jar file. So, I mean, I'm going to talk about those three main things, you know, the multi-release jar files, modularization, and the new JLink tool, which kind of allows you to, you know, create a, you know, export a, what they call, what's now called a runtime image, but it's really essentially a private JRE that is tailored toward exactly what you want. So, again, this is a kind of a side thing, but, you know, a lot of problems with supporting legacy Java is just making sure that the customer has the right JRE, and this is kind of an easier way to guarantee that than the old way of kind of like hand assembling your own private JRE. So this is really a legacy thing going forward. I mean, it won't really apply to, you know, Java 8 and earlier in that case, but it's something that you know, people who create Java 9 stuff that becomes legacy code will eventually be able to take advantage of. So those are the three main features that I'm going to discuss. Actually, it's a birds of a feather session, so, you know, usually that's all about discussion, but I have prepared a presentation. We'll see whether I actually give it or whether it goes to a discussion.
So bringing it back to the world of enterprise software development with Java, where might an enterprise developer find an application for multi-release jar files?
Okay, well, I mean, the idea that I've been thinking of is, you know, we have a bunch of cases where we do something in our code that essentially uses, you know, Java 5 APIs, and it's kind of ugly. And maybe it doesn't do everything we want. You know, maybe it's a hack. Maybe, you know, we'd like more capabilities. And in Java 9, they come out with a much simpler, more straightforward way of doing it. I mean, the canonical example that's been published is the whole idea of getting a, you know, the you know, a native process ID from, you know, in your Java code. You know, find out what the Windows process ID or the Linux process ID is of a particular process. And the way you used to be able to do that was from some, you know, incredibly ugly hack that only worked on, you know, standard Java, you know, distributions, but had to do with, you know, accessing, you know, Java management bean stuff and then taking a string and then crossing your fingers and hoping it was the right format and parsing it so you could find the product ID or the process ID. And then, you know, you could either do it, you know, you could do it that way, and then, but now in Java 9, there's actually an API call. You know, process handle has an API that actually will get you that native process ID. So it's much simpler and more reliable. Now, what do you do if you want to use that process, you know, that new API? Well, you know, the way things you used to have to do is essentially probe the API using reflection, or query the, you know, the Java runtime to ask what version it is. But that was a whole other kettle of fish because the, you know, the version string up until Java 9 was non-standard, you know, so parsing that was kind of an adventure. But generally what you would do is, like, you know, probe the API, just see, you know, use reflection to see whether it exists or not. If it does, you know, you're in Java 9 and you use it. Otherwise, you use the kludge. And, you know, we have a lot of, I don't know about a lot, but a number of places in our code where we actually do things like probe the API, do it the old-fashioned way, if the API isn't there, and otherwise, you know, use reflection to use the new API, because, of course, we're targeting our code, you know, both our you know, source and our binaries to you know, toward Java 5. So, you know, it'll run in Java 9, but, you know, you'll have, you know, you need to do this late binding to see whether or not, you know, an API is really there. So that's kind of an example. You know, I could probably dig other examples out, but that's, you know, the example of process ID is actually a pretty good one.
Now, we saw modularity and OSGI be applied to a lot of vendor tools and products that software developers use, but a lot of enterprise developers are wondering where they might use the Java module system and how Jigsaw might fit into their enterprise development and enterprise deployment. How do you deal with that? How do you answer that question? Where can you see an enterprise developer using Java modules?
You can pretend all your JAR files are modules without changing them, mostly, not entirely, and put them all in the module path, but you won't get any win from doing it because, because, you know, if the system doesn't know anything about your module's dependencies, it'll just assume that it depends on everything. And that everything depends on it. The wins come when you start doing incremental future development, and you start, you know, creating new JAR files, and then you might decide, oh, I will make those modular, and that's creating, you know, making a brand new JAR file modular and specifying the dependencies is not a heavy lift. And so at that point, you've added a modular, you know, a modular JAR file. You know, if it's multi-release, you know, it'll still work with your legacy stuff. You can use it in legacy situations and pretend it's not a modular JAR file, you know, assuming that the binaries are targeted toward something pre-Java 9. But yeah, it's more for the incremental follow-on improvements. Now, I think that you have a very good point that somebody is going to come out with a product, an analysis product, that will analyze your code and essentially propose, you know, a module, you know, all the module dependencies if your JAR files were modular, and, you know, even generate those moduleinfo.class files and you know, inject them into the JAR files. And I think that would be a great idea, and that would probably be another way to get, you know, legacy enterprise developers into it. But you know, I mean, that's the fact they're enterprise developers. They're creating big systems, and I really do think that, you know, any modularity you can introduce into the product is going to be a win. But, you know, just start by not doing anything and pretending your stuff are already, you know, automatic modules, and just see if that works. You know, and I think that's probably another thing that the designers of this thing were doing to essentially ease legacy developers into the new system. I mean, I think that's going to happen in a few years. You know, people who are wondering whether this was a good idea or not are not even going to think about it. They're going to wonder what they were worried about.
So what's your take on all the announcements that Oracle has made lately, ranging from the release train approach to new Java releases to the fact that they want to move Java to the Eclipse Foundation? Is Oracle getting better at handling PR before these Java 1 events?
They may well be. You know, I think that, you know, their announcements, not only Java 9 and Java EE 8, but the whole thing about the enhanced release cadence and the and essentially splitting some of these duties with OpenJDK and that whole bit. I think that, you know, the development community, one, likes the message, and two, likes the fact that Oracle is delivering any message at all. You know, that it means that Oracle is paying attention to Java now. So I think that you know, I think you're right. I think Oracle is getting their message, you know, their Java messaging better. And on the other hand, of course, they weren't doing a very good job. So even doing it a little bit better would have gotten, you know, a lot of people, you know, enthusiastic and taking notice. But I think they're doing actually a pretty good job now. We'll see what happens as things play out.
Now, I don't remember seeing JM Bridge last year in the Exhibitors Hall for Java 1. What is it that's brought you guys back?
Yeah, well, we've actually taken a few years off, but we're coming back now because we have a brand new product. It's called Java.vs. It's a complete Java language system for Visual Studio. So people will be able to write their Java applications in Visual Studio now. It's a Visual Studio extension with you know, project system and a build system, compilation. It's based on you know, Eclipse JDT on the back end to do a lot of the the maintenance of the the source tree and the syntax tree and things like that. The whole idea is to give Java developers the same Visual Studio experience that people who develop in first-class Visual Studio languages like C# and Visual Basic and C++ and F# are getting.
So who's your prototypical client? Is it someone working in the Java EE world that needs to learn .NET, or is it someone that's working in the .NET world that has to do a little bit of development with Java EE?
That's a good question. I think some of each. I think one scenario are companies that do both Java and .NET and want to settle on and support a single IDE, who want to move in, you know, and one possibility, actually probably the best possibility in that case, would be Visual Studio, especially if they're already, you know, buying licenses for it. The other scenario about the Java developer or C# developer who's moving to Java or Java developer who needs to move into C#. That's the other scenario. There are a lot of comments that we've kind of seen in various places online about people who, you know, used to be C# developers and in their new job or in a new assignment they're doing Java. And, you know, they really miss Visual Studio. I mean, that's not to say Eclipse is a bad environment. We, you know, we use it for our Java development. We haven't yet gotten to the dog fooding part, but that's getting very close. You know, and other environments like NetBeans and IntelliJ, JetBrains IntelliJ. But I think a lot of people, miss the experience they get in Visual Studio and would be very happy to have it back in their job development. And we also have heard that a fair number of people who are new to Visual Studio would like to use Java. There is evidence that that's the case.
So Visual Studio has been out for a really long time. Why has it taken till 2017 to develop a really good tool for doing enterprise Java inside of Microsoft's flagship tool?
It's not easy. Well, I mean, the first reason is that Microsoft isn't going to do it. For various historical and business reasons, they're not going to do it themselves. But I think they're happy to see somebody else do it. As far as why it's taken so long, besides that, I think it's hard. Visual Studio extensibility is not the easiest thing to do. Certain parts of Visual Studio extensibility, like debugger extensibility, are even more arcane. It's hard, and I think that. You need a special expertise to be able to do that part of it. And the other part of it is, since we're leveraging a lot of Java infrastructure in this, Eclipse JDT based stuff, from the .NET based Visual Studio or Visual Studio APIs, it helps to have some interop capability, which, we just happen to have. We're essentially using our own technology, our Java.NET interoperability technology to help build this new product.
Where do they find out more information?
They can find out more on our website, jnbridge.com. On the front page, there's some links so that they can sign up for early access or notification of general availability, and we hope they do.